Welcome to Synapse's Brain Bank podcast, a place for people and families impacted by brain injury to share their stories and connect with specialists from the field. Join our host, Dr. Zara Whedon, as we hear from everyday Australians and tap into advice and resources to help you on your brain injury path.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Today I'm talking to Cheryl Dedman, who despite serious medical complications, still deals with the lack of understanding that can come with an invisible disability. Welcome, Cheryl. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi, I am 55 years old now. When I was just about to turn 26, I had a brain tumour removed. At that point in time, I was living in Melbourne, and luckily, really, because that's where my tumour was discovered, with my husband Pete, who'd been transferred there from a country, Victoria, when he just started a job. They figured out that it was a pituitary tumour, but it wasn't in the pituitary gland as such. It was actually outside on the stalk. So when it was pressing on the pituitary stalk, that was when I was having a lot of problems. I think the operation went for about 6 hours, and my husband was waiting at home, but then he just couldn't wait at home. He came in and waited at the hospital. And I had been told before the operation that there were risks, and that was that I could have a stroke. I could lose my eyesight. I could lose my memory. I could also have epilepsy. So when I woke up and I looked at a nurse who I had been conversing with during her shifts in the hospital, I remember her name. I said, "Oh, Joan." And they said, "Oh, she's got a memory. She can see," which was really, really good. So, ta-da, you know, everything was really great.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, Cheryl, and guess it probably wasn't quite that simple.
Well, actually, whilst I was in the hospital, I'd been overdosed on the medication Minirin, because one of the things that developed was diabetes insipidus, which is different to diabetes mellitus, in that this is all to do with the urine control in your body, because I'd lost the capacity to make that hormone. So instead of giving me 0.005, they gave me 0.5, which was huge. And all of a sudden, I didn't have to go to the toilet. Look, I'm cured. This is fantastic. And then I'd also then been given by mistake Valium. And so I was got up in the middle of the night and thinking, I'm feeling fantastic. I started wandering around. All of a sudden, my head was on the mirror in the ensuite. I don't know, I must have got some nurses to come in. So they put me into bed and they put the sides up on the bed, which I remember I wasn't very happy about, because that was like, you know, being a baby. And in my state of mind, I wasn't very happy. So eventually I went home after, I think, another 14 days. And I was told, well, it looks like we can't work it out. You should not be having control over your urine. So went home and I'm thinking, I'm a bit of a miracle, really. And went home, and all of a sudden, when we got home, I was just going to the toilet massively, massively. And it was so bad. I got taken back to emergency, and my husband explained, because he was there when they gave me the Minirin, and they said, "Now, you only had 0.005, and it would have been this amount." And my husband said, "No, it was this, half of the vial was full." And I said, "Okay. So you've been overdosed." So then we had to work out how much. So I no longer produced hormones. So everything had to be worked out of a standard dose. And that was where a lot of problems began. I began thinking, well, I need to have a really, really healthy diet to keep my body at its best. And so in doing so, I was having a lot of fruit and vegetables. And no one would believe me, but the content from the fruit and vegetables actually accounts to the water content. So I ended up having so much fluid in me that I collapsed and needed to be taken to emergency. Very, very lucky, because of all the fluid in my body with the potassium levels in my body, that I didn't have a heart attack. So that was really, really lucky. So going back to the neurosurgeon after about 6 weeks, I think it was, and he said, so the tumour had been sent around the world to pathology units to try and work out what it was. It was not something that had been come across before, but it was what I was told was on the benign side of things. So there's apparently a scale. It's not just benign and malignant. So I went back to work, and I must say that my workmates were really like a family. They didn't treat me as if I couldn't do anything. They trusted me, and that support was really amazing from them, and I will always be very grateful and thankful. For the wider community, and probably much closer to home, it was really difficult. My family, I had asked them specifically not to tell anyone about me having a brain tumour, because I can remember as a child sitting at the table and talking about who's got cancer and who's going to die, and I just didn't want to be the topic of everyone's dinner conversation. So they really weren't understanding, and I do remember one day they came to visit, because they're on a farm, they came to visit me down in Melbourne, and my husband was at work, and I just didn't know what to do with them, because they seemed to just want me to be something that I couldn't be. I was extremely depressed. I was rocking myself back and forwards again. I didn't know, it's really hard to explain, I just didn't know what to do. I couldn't be who they wanted me to be. I was supposed to be better. The tumour had been taken out, but I wasn't feeling better. I was feeling really alone. All this stuff was happening in my body that I couldn't control. And, you know, the depression was pretty bad. A lot of other close people really didn't know what to say to me. And if I'd start to talk about it, they really didn't want to continue the conversation. So I learned just to shut it down. And I had to deal with all the other things. One of the hardest things really was the diabetes insipidus, because once the medication wears off for that, you need to go to the toilet a lot. You have to plan your whole day around it. So if you're going to go shopping, you go like when you've taken the medication. And for travelling, that was really, really hard. You know, you'd be going for about half an hour to go to the toilet again, and then trying to find a toilet that was not exactly easy. So that would become, I've become very anxious about that as well. And even asking someone if I was at their home, you know, can I use your toilet, please? And then wanting to use it again a little while later, I feel really embarrassed about it. So there was a lot of working through things, but I'd also put on a lot of weight due to the hormones, which was not helping me with my self-esteem. So I decided to do some walking for causes. And the people at my work were really wonderful. They'd sponsor me and they'd say, you know, you go for it. And I remember just walking for any cause, and walking, you know, felt a little bit like Forrest Gump. And I just walked for this and walked for that. And, yeah, I was losing weight. Even though I was feeling desolate, I still have something in me that says, well, standing up for myself, I guess, is probably the best way to say it. And this is something that I had to do a lot as a young girl in my family. And I brought that to me in those times and just thought, I can make a better life. I don't really have anyone that can do this for me, because I went to the Melbourne Library to try and find information on pituitary disorders. There was one paragraph in a medical journal. No one could tell me anything except that it was rare, and the being rare, well, that wasn't such a good thing to be. I really wanted to be something that other people could understand. My husband was supporting me really, really well. He, not knowing about the condition either, was really difficult for him. So he was helping me to become the best me, and I'll always appreciate that. having those few sparks in life, like my husband and also the people at my work, was probably what just got me through that time. So I have no pituitary function whatsoever.
That sounds hard.
It is. Really, really hard. I'm now on a tablet, which is a little bit more manageable and it's a bit longer lasting during the day. So I feel a bit freer. I mean, originally I was told by a nurse in hospital that when I had to go back, I'd had a relapse with my health. And she said, well, you know, just be prepared to be in and out of hospital for the rest of your life. And I said, no, that's not what's going to be. And the diabetes insipidus is most likely the hardest thing about having panhypopituitarism. So no function whatsoever with the pituitary gland. It's invasive, like it's pervasive. It's just everything. Your whole body is dependent upon the pituitary gland. And when you have to replace everything with just a dose, that is a standard dose that doesn't account for the stresses of life, that doesn't account for the weather. So the weather plays a really big role with your urinary output and intake as well. All of these things, all of the factors of what you eat have a huge impact. Your exercise, it's really, really huge. And working your life around that at the same time as feeling that you don't want to be standing out as someone that's weird or different because, oh, you know, got to go to the toilet all the time or having to take medication up your nose and things like that. It's a really hard line. It sounds probably for anyone that's not dealing with it, oh, that wouldn't be so hard. But you know what? It is, because you've got to think of where's the next toilet. And I was also told that I just would have to always be, you know, near home, near the fridge where medication had to be kept. Well, no, that's not going to happen either. So I got a cool bag and an ice block. I took my medication. I mean, how simple was that? Because I'm not going to be bound to home. I'm an adventurer and I want to be able to immerse myself in our outdoors, and that's part of who I am still. We like to go caravanning and free camping, and our son, who is a great photographer, we go lots of places where, you know, he can be immersed in nature as well, because that's what soothes the soul and the photos that come from that as well.
It sounds like understanding or lack of understanding has been a defining feature of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Having panhypopituitarism is not defined as a disability, but it affects my ability in what I can do and where I can go. That is really, really hard, because you look at me and you're not going to see it. I mean, if you look at my face hard enough, you can see that, you know, my eyes aren't quite straight and all that sort of thing. But otherwise, you just can't see it. So people not being able to accept others for just how they are is an incredible thing, I think. We all have something, no matter whether it's a brain injury or a physical injury, that affects us in some way. For some of us, it's a lot more than others. And it's something that is lifelong. It's not going to be something that we can just do some sort of therapy and it's all going to disappear. Therapy can help us to get through things. That's really good. But it's always going to be there. And another thing also is how I do things can be very different. I think I'd be described by a lot as being eccentric. That's how I can live my life. If I find joy in something, just the littlest of things, people will know about it, because I just lap it up, that it's the little things that make a big difference. And I love those little things. I love, actually, just looking out my window, I've got what I call my garden of joy. It's the flowers that I plant in the autumn. And I've got pansies and violas and poppies and stocks out there, and they're just, when I step out the back door, that's what hits me in the eye. And that just, I only have to just go and look at it and I just start to feel some sort of joy. And that's how I am in life. Even though the way that I cope, I have so many lists. I have 3 books of lists, so for 3 different subjects. And having those lists really helps me to think, I'm not going to forget, because I'm worried that I'm going to forget. So having those lists really helps me to stay not as stressed about things as well. And that's an adaption, and that's okay. But there's a lot of other things that I've needed to adapt in my life and just be accepting of the way that I do things, because that's what makes me feel good. It's not harmful to other people. My eldest son, I think he would definitely say I'm really eccentric. But it is the way that I can cope. I need to bring some sort of joy into my life. It's not something I deliberately go out there and say I'm going to go and freak people out. But I need to be able to cope.
So, Cheryl, you're talking about pursuing joy. Have you felt there's been a pressure on you to feel grateful?
Absolutely. And I go back to when, you know, my parents came and visited me that day in Melbourne after my surgery, and I really was just meant to be grateful that I was alive. And, you know, the tumour's gone. It's okay. But it wasn't okay. I was facing still an uncertain future because I still didn't know how this illness was going to affect me.
For anyone who is listening to some of the issues that we've touched on today and maybe struggling, do you, Cheryl, have any advice?
Yes. And look, it all depends on where you live and what sort of people are around you. It's easy enough for me to say, look, reach out to someone and get support. Probably the biggest thing I would say is to try and find some joy in your life. And even if it's only a little thing, but to try and build up on those little things. Because without those little bits of joy, it is very difficult to be able to sustain what you need to be able to do in life, in caring for yourself and also for others around you. And it is important to reach out to others, but also if you do reach out, make sure it is someone that you really trust and that you know you can say anything to and they're not going to judge you. They'll listen.
Yeah. It's been lovely talking with you, Cheryl.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Brain Bank podcast, brought to you by Synapse, Australia's peak body for brain injury. Make sure you visit our website, synapse.org.au, where you'll find useful resources and tools to connect you to our brain injury community. And while you're there, please complete the podcast survey. We want to know what you've enjoyed, what's worked for you, and what you think we should cover in the next series. At Synapse, we're creating change for people from all walks of life who have been impacted by brain injury. Remember to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode.